Support comes from Ohio University's Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service, a proud member of Ohio University's Health Collaborative, with the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine and the College of Health Sciences and Professions. We are partnering with local providers and communities to improve public health. Information is available at ohio.edu/Voinovich-school.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jazzed About Work, where we talk about everything that might have an impact on your career. I'm your host, Bev Jones. I'm an executive coach, and I wrote the book, Find Your Happy at Work. And today, we are talking about honeybees. Yes, those beautiful, energetic insects who work in teams to create delicious honey. Our guest is Siobhan McHale, whose new book is The Hive Mind at Work. The subtitle of that book is Harnessing the Power of Group Intelligence to Create Meaningful and Lasting Change. Siobhan has worked around the world helping thousands of leaders to create more productive and collaborative organizations. And she's come up with a change model, which is inspired by the amazing way bees in a hive work together. She says, they may look like they're just buzzing around, but in fact, a bee colony gets things done by creating a sophisticated ecostructure. Siobhan will describe how in organizations, like in a hive, everyone is connected, and leaders are more successful when they understand how people interact. Siobhan, I am so excited to talk with you today. I'm a big fan of bees, and I'm a big fan of your new book. But before we get into all of that, I would love to hear a little bit about your career story and how did you get so interested in change and in bees?
Yeah, thanks, Beverly. And I grew up on a farm in Ireland. And as a young child, I was fascinated by the bees as they swarmed in the orchard on the farm. And this fascination with natural ecosystems actually led me into a career studying human ecosystems or groups. First as an organizational psychologist, which is what I studied at university. And then I spent a decade as a management consultant, flying in and out of hundreds of companies across four continents, helping leaders to manage change. And then after that 10 years as a consultant, I actually wanted to roll up my sleeves and do change or lead change myself. So the second part of my career has been as the executive in charge of transformation in a series of international firms. And my book, the latest book, The Hive Mind at Work, is about change from an insider perspective. So a lot of books have been written, great books written by consultants and academics, but I give the insider perspective of an executive in charge of change in a series of firms and what you notice from that role, Beverly.
Well, I think it's a really fascinating book. I like the fact that you have a practical look at kind of a complicated thing, which is how people interact in an organization. Could you tell a little bit about the intelligence of bees and, you know, how does that work and how is that like the intelligence of an organizational group?
Yeah, so the bees have what I call a hive mind or this group intelligence. And it is an intelligence that I think is really important. I think if you look at how we think about intelligence, we often think about IQ, which is important for problem solving, technical problem solving, rational thinking, critical analysis. Then we've got EQ or emotional intelligence, which gained traction with Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, which is really understanding your own emotions and managing those and being able to understand the emotions of others. But the third critical intelligence in workplaces is group intelligence. And this is the ability to understand how groups function and to be able to intervene in groups in order to help them to deliver, to grow, and to adapt. So bees have that in spades, and I think we also need to develop our understanding of how groups function and how we can nudge them in order to help them to be higher performing.
Your book, the way it's, you know, practical help is you have a model. You talk about group dynamics and the importance of understanding that, how the pieces fit together. Could you tell us a little bit about your model?
Sure. Well, the book is in two parts. The first part is the 9 laws of group dynamics, Beverly, and it's really important that we understand how groups function. And you may have noticed that people as individuals can behave in one way, but when they're in a group, they can behave in a very different way. So how can you as a person and maybe a manager in the workforce, how can you begin to better understand these 9 laws of group dynamics? And then the second part of the book takes you through the 4 stages of change that a group goes through and what you need to do to accelerate that change and bring about transformation in groups with less noise. So that's the 2 parts of the book, Beverly.
Well, let's start with the 9 laws of group dynamics. I think the basic one, which is much more important than people realize, and if they take nothing else from the book, I think it's patterns. Tell us about how patterns tend to shape how things get done.
Yeah, so groups are complex human ecosystems, are paradoxical because on the one hand, you see a lot of complexity, but on the other hand, they are underpinned by simple rules or patterns, if only we can see these patterns. So an example was when I walked into the ANZ Bank, where there was a lot of dysfunction. It was the worst performing bank in the country, actually, when I joined. And it went on 7 years later to become the best performing bank in the country and the number one bank on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. A major transformation that was brought about by seeing the big pattern that was running the organization. So that pattern, which executives were failing to see, and they had restructured the bank, but that had only taken it backwards. So what was actually going on at the bank was that head office had stepped into the role of order giver, giving directions and instructions to the 700 bank branches that had stepped into the role of order taker. So they just saw themselves as the victims who had no control and were just taking the order from head office. And this pattern had led, you know, it was basically a hidden agreement between these two parts that you take the orders from head office. And that was leading to disengagement and very poor customer satisfaction. Once we saw that pattern, then we could intervene in the bank in order to start to bring about change.
So when I was reading the book, it struck me that I've been working on an issue that recognizing patterns and creating change, where those things are very important. And my day job is I'm an executive coach. I work with leaders. I'm a former lawyer, so very often with leader lawyers, and often in very complex organizations like big universities or federal government, United States government agencies. And, you know, they're not the kinds of organizations where change happens quickly. And in recent years, everybody's been struggling with how can we move more quickly. But when COVID hit here in the United States, I think I was working with maybe 6 or 7 different federal units, you know, departments or agencies. And in a matter of a month, everything changed. What happened was none of the patterns were relevant anymore. Everybody had to go home. There was an emergency. Some of the people were responsible for getting the word out to the citizens, and change happened in an instant. And I thought, you know, what happened is that most of the time in these big organizations, everybody's clinging to their pattern. They want comfort of having things be the same. But all of a sudden, that clinging to patterns was irrelevant and everybody knew it. And so change happened very quickly. And I think every organization I was working with did a terrific job of getting used to virtual work, even though, you know, at the beginning they didn't even have the technology for it. In a month, and things started to happen. Now, all these years later, there is lots of need for change and interest in change, but people are, I think, even more resistant to change on issues like remote work or, you know, the structure of organizations. It's very, very slow. So let's say you're a consultant and you're coming into an organization where change has happened once, maybe in when there was an emergency, but now everything is stuck. So the first thing you do is, as a consultant, is you as you look at the patterns and you kind of understand what happens. And but then how do you convince people that change is necessary? How do you get them moving?
Yeah, excellent question. And I think one of the places to start, as you say, is what I call mapping the ecosystem. And then what we need to do often is change the collective mental map of people's roles. So you talked about, you know, people suddenly during COVID times switch their mental map from I'm an office worker to I'm a virtual worker. That mental map shapes our behavior almost like a GPS in your car. It directs you, it shapes how you think, it directs your journey. And even a simple example, let's say, of Anna, who's, I talk about this in the book, The Hive Mind at Work, where I talk about a co-founder of a business who has a warehouse in San Francisco, and she comes into work one morning and her whole warehouse is flooded. Now, Anna, by nature, is a very introverted, quite shy person. But that morning when she comes into her warehouse, she steps into role of crisis manager to direct her staff to, you know, turn off the electricity, call the insurance company, start to sweep out the water and remove the wet boxes of clothing from the warehouse. And that evening, as she drives home, she really thinks about that. Wow, you know, it turned from a shy, rather introverted person into this crisis manager. Now, has Anna changed her personality? No, she is still the same Anna, but her behavior changes as the mental map of her role changes. So we can change our behavior quite quickly if we shift this mental map of role. But often we're trying to bring about change by changing people's personality or labeling their behavior as resistant or resistors, when in actual fact, that behavior may have worked for the ecosystem on some levels. So it's understanding the behavior, the assumptions behind that behavior, and then helping people to shift their mental map of their role, I would say, Beverly, is a really good place to start.
If you're, again, working with an organization, you have a leader who recognizes, maybe she's like Anna, and just jumps in and starts to do what's necessary. What if people say, hey, that's not my job. I'm not going to do this. I don't know how to do this. How do you create an atmosphere of willingness? Is it partly, you know, as a coach, what I would think I would do is I would, just as you looked at patterns, you'd go in and listen to people. And maybe that's the starting point, if change isn't happening, to go in and find out what people are really thinking. Is that a good starting point?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't bring about change unless you adhere to one of the 9 laws of group dynamics, which is the law of multiple perspectives. Each part of the ecosystem may be having a different view or has a different lens, is holding a different set of assumptions when it comes to the change. And you, as a leader of that change, must understand those assumptions before you can intervene to successfully bring about change. Otherwise, you will probably be faced with another of the laws of group dynamics, which is the law of unintended consequences. When people don't fully understand the ecosystem that they're walking into and how to nudge that ecosystem, they often get the blowback. They get the unintended consequences of putting in change without fully understanding what people are thinking and feeling. And another tip I give to leaders of change is to map the ecosystem. Actually sit down, maybe with a coach or a trusted advisor, and physically draw that ecosystem. And the groups within that ecosystem, so the critical individuals within that ecosystem or group, and what roles are they taking up? So you might have some people who are in role of skeptic, others who are active resistors, others who are open to change, others who have a lot to lose, others who have a lot to gain. Like, what systemic role, not job role, systemic role are these different parts of the organization or the department or the team taking up in relation to the change? And what reframe do you need to bring about in order to nudge this change along? Because reframing role often helps people to step into a different role during change.
You know, I do something like that as a coach very often at the beginning. I tend to work with, as I said, leaders in complex organizations, and sometimes they may have hundreds or thousands of people in their sector, and sometimes, maybe it's 4 that report to them directly. So the things can vary a lot. But what I often do is what I ask them to do is do what I call a wire diagram or something like that. I ask them, and I ask it because partly it helps, it's going to help me work with them if I know what's happening, but I want them to look at things in a way that maybe is fresh. And to take the exercise of telling me things, how things work, to kind of pause and look. And so the first couple of times we talk together, I'll ask them to tell me, who do you report to? Who reports to you? Who are your colleagues? Who are the people you bump in the most? Are there people that have kind of a different position than you, where there's a natural conflict? And as they talk to me about it, I think that kind of happens almost organically. They're not thinking of themselves as mapping, and I haven't described it that way. But that really is a good starting point, isn't it, for lots of different situations?
Yeah, it's making what you may have been subject to object. So you're mapping your system, and a little bit like the ANZ Bank example, where the executives couldn't see the hidden pattern, but once we saw that head office was in role of order giver, we could reframe the role of the head office and say, you're no longer the order givers, you're now the customer service enablers. Your job is to enable the bank branches to deliver great customer service to customers. And then we could reframe the role of the branches from order takers, feeling like victims, to actually know you are the customer service leaders. You must decide what's best for the customers and how you're going to deliver that service. So the whole reframe was not changing their job. It's reframing their mental map of their role. And that reframe and that redesign of the operating model, which I talk about in the book, was really the kickstart of this major transformation that turned staff engagement around, that increased customer satisfaction by 30%+. Profits doubled in 7 years, the share price trebled in 7 years, and as I said, the bank became the number one bank on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index globally. And part of that was reframing and redesigning the operating model, which bees do beautifully during their change as well.
Tell us just about how the bees have to do that when, say, the time comes when they have to maybe move to another hive. How does that work?
Well, bees are fascinating because when they know that the hive is overcrowded and there won't be enough food for them to survive the long winter months, half the hive, which could be up to 20,000 bees, decide to swarm and go in search of a new home. So they stop foraging, stop doing their daily activities of foraging and cleaning the hive, and they go to a nearby branch, and 200 of the bees step into the role of real estate agents to search for a new home for the hive. So they go and search in hollow tree branches or old barns or wherever they can find a cavity or a space that's going to be suitable for the hive. So other bees step into the role of protectors of the swarm as they sit on a nearby branch. So the whole hive that's leaving takes up a completely different role. It switches its operating model in order to find a new home for half the hive and to successfully set up that new home and start to build it from scratch. So they really teach us a lot.
It's fascinating that this huge group of insects can work together and collectively figure things out and do it so smoothly. It's amazing. But that's the story that kind of reminded me of what it was like at COVID. It's like everybody knew they had to act. They had to do something. And it might mean taking a different role or doing things in a different way. But it worked. But let's go to, I think, more ordinary times when there's not a huge move or a huge crisis. Sometimes people may even agree with the need for change theoretically, and yet a lot of people just have an inborn hesitancy. They don't like change. And you said maybe when that happens, it's time for what you call, like, I love the way you expressed it. It's time for the gentle art of nudging. You know, it's sometimes you can have the change, you can get people to say yes to the change, but you can't quit there. So how does an adept nudger keep people moving along?
Yeah, the gentle art of nudging, the bees do this as well. They nudge each other or slightly headbutt each other when it's time for the bees to start to swarm and find a new home. And really adept leaders, as you mentioned, do this also. They understand that in complex human ecosystems, that if you push hard for change, guess what? The system pushes back. So you create what I call the pushback pattern. I push, but then the group pushes back harder. And we see lots and lots of examples of this in our daily lives. So as a leader, you've got to avoid triggering the pushback pattern, and you've got to gently nudge the ecosystem to change and nudge the various groups. And this is where I love this concept of reframing. You reframe people's roles. So going back to the ANZ bank examples, there wasn't a force used. We basically took 32,000 people across the bank through a course that was called Breakout, which is a 3-day workshop. And we basically in that workshop reframed their role. So if you were in head office, we said, no, you're not giving instructions anymore. You're the enabler. So your job is to enable the branches, whether it be through IT support or systems or risk management or HR or whatever the support service you're providing, you're there to enable the bank branches to deliver better customer service to our customers. So how you do that is up to you. We're not going to dictate terms, but we're going to reframe your role as a critical lead enabler. And then people walked away from the workshop and started thinking about, okay, I've got this new mental map of my role. It's not the same as it was in the past, but it's up to me to decide how I take up that role. So that was the gentle art of nudging in the ANZ Bank example.
The book, like many books about change, is shaped as something for leaders, very often senior leaders, to do. They're the people who are struggling to figure out how do we come up with a change process. But in fact, in your examples and with the bees and in life, every person in an organization can be a change agent. We all can do it. And I think sometimes the way you learn to change is by kind of learning the hard way, that the way to do it is nudging, not by demand. So a junior person can play a role in promoting change. Don't you think that part of, I'm guessing with a 3-day workshop, part of the things you're doing is recruiting people so more people will see themselves as change agents as well as somebody who has to change their own role?
Yeah. Any person in any part of the group or the human ecosystem can bring about change, no matter where they sit, because of one of the laws of group dynamics, which is the law of connectedness. All behavior is connected and all behavior has a ripple effect. So patterns are like a dance. If you change the steps of the dance, the dancer with you, the person who's dancing with you, has to change as well. And so often we're trying to change the dancers rather than change the dance. You know, we've got to change the pattern. We've got to start creating the ripples during change. And you can do that because of the law of connectedness. You can influence change from anywhere in the group. It doesn't have to be the leader. Now, of course, the leader, because of positional power, has incredible influence, enormous influence on the group, but it is not the only place where change can start from. So never forget that no matter where you sit in an organization, your behavior has the ability to have an influence. Yeah, I think one of the critical parts of change is the first stage. I talk about the four steps during change. And the first step is look beyond. So as a leader, you've got to look beyond the obvious to see the underlying hidden patterns in the organization. And often we don't know how to do that. And this is where group intelligence comes in. So we've got to be able to assess or diagnose, like in the ANZ example, what are the hidden patterns or the hidden agreements that are running this situation or running this team or running this organization? And that requires a different way of rewiring our brains for the systemic, not just for the behavior, which sits at the individual level, but the collective or systemic patterns, which sit sit more at that collective level. So as a leader, how can you see those patterns? Like in the ANZ example, where the executives were at a loss to know how to intervene to bring about change. They had tried to restructure the bank, that had only taken it backwards. And then once they were able to see the hidden agreement, which was the order taker pattern, you know, head office gives orders to the bank branches, this order taker pattern was the key thing that they needed to shift. And I give lots of examples of these hidden patterns in the book, The Hive Mind at Work, that can help leaders to begin to see complex ecosystems and how they function. It's a different way of thinking. It is group intelligence. Mm-hmm. We are not taught about group intelligence. We're taught about IQ, Beverly, or EQ. But this group intelligence is I think the next horizon for leaders.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting look at the way things work. And we're almost out of time here, I think. But before we go, would you tell us what are the, so there are four stages, right? And we've talked about the first one. What are the other stages?
Yeah, so it's called the Hive Lens. And Lens is the four stages of change in groups. The L stands for look beyond. You've got to look beyond and see these hidden patterns or agreements in complex human ecosystems. The E stands for experiment. Often during complexity and working with groups of people, you must start to experiment to emerge the change and emerge the solutions. The N in the Hive Lens stands for nudge. You've got to nudge the ecosystem rather than push for change or push and shove people. And the S stands for strengthen. You've got to strengthen the emerging change. You've got to help embed the emerging change. Otherwise, it is at risk of fizzling out. So there are lots of practical tools and case studies in the book from my years as a change leader that help people to really ground their thinking and make this book, I hope, practical for managers, for advisors, and for people in human resources as well.
I think the book is beautifully written and the information is very accessible and the B's make it particularly fun. I just want to repeat the full title again. The title is The Hive Mind at Work and the subtitle is Harnessing the Power of Group Intelligence to Create Meaningful and Lasting Change. And I think folks who have maybe they're in an organization which is looking at change and they're given all kinds of rather tedious things to read sometimes. This maybe goes beyond some of the material that's out there, and I think it's a good starting point unless you're really kind of a leadership nerd. You might want to start with this book. So thank you so much for telling us about it, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much, Beverly. I enjoyed the conversation.
Well, have a great day.
Thank you.
Today we've been talking with Siobhan McHale about how a key to organizational change is understanding group dynamics. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Beverly Jones, author of Think Like an Entrepreneur, Act Like a CEO. And our sponsor is the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service at Ohio University. Today's tip is that you will be more successful in promoting an organizational change if you start by noticing the unwritten patterns that shape how people interact with one another. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed today's show, please tell your friends.